From Oklahoma to Virginia, Maine to Colorado, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, did the anti-price gouging laws enacted in the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic inadvertently contribute to the spread of the virus? Gavin Roberts from the Center for Growth and Opportunity is here with the answer. That massive $1.9 trillion stimulus bill, supposedly to fight the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic, has been approved by Congress. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Less than 10% of money in the American Recovery Act actually will go to fighting COVID-19. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine is here to detail the pork barrel spending. And Donald Trump may or may not again be a candidate for the presidency, so conservatives need to find their own way forward. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Anti-price gouging laws put into place during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic resulted in a shortage of some products, prompting more shopping trips, which then contributed to the spread of the virus. That is the finding of research conducted in part by Gavin Roberts. Gavin is an assistant professor of economics at Weber State University, and he has produced a report for the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. He is here to discuss the report's findings. Gavin, welcome to American Radio Journal. Professor, at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, there were a number of anti-price gouging laws that kicked in and a number of states that passed them. What was the climate like, the situation like, that prompted states to put these laws into effect last spring?
So there's actually two situations. One situation, in the majority of states that enacted price gouging regulations during the COVID-19 pandemic, actually had pre-existing price gouging regulations on their books. But the way those regulations tend to work is that they become binding, or they become enacted or active during a public health emergency. So for example, in a state like California or Louisiana, when the governor of the state declares an emergency situation, pre-existing price gouging regulations go into effect. On the other hand, there were some states that my co-author and I describe as surprise price gouging regulations or emergency price gouging regulations that did not have price gouging regulations on the books prior to COVID-19. And that actually is consistent with historical events in the states that had pre-existing price gouging regulation. For example, the reason that Louisiana was one of the earliest states to have price gouging regulation is because it's a state that is often confronted with public emergencies in the way of hurricanes. And that's when those price gouging laws tend to come up. And politicians tend to use verbiage like exorbitant price increases, greedy profiteers, things like that. So it's really, I've looked at a lot of what politicians were saying around that time, and it's very much associated with how we feel about observing people taking advantage of emergency situations. And so you have a lot of that kind of emotional language around why these laws are coming up. You will find politicians saying some stuff like, we want prices to be broadly available at low prices. And that's what they use as the reasoning for anti-price gouging laws. But our research actually shows, and economic theory really shows, that those two things tend to be inconsistent, low prices and broadly available, particularly in emergency situations. Because emergency situations cause a situation of more scarcity. For example, gasoline in a hurricane, hotel rooms in a hurricane. So it's difficult to politically make those broadly available isn't really a possibility. So there is a little bit, we want to be careful when we have those things because we want to think about that in an economic context. And that's what my co-author and I decided to do at that point, when at the time you're talking about when those things started to show up.
Interestingly, as your research unfolded, you found that there was a very significant and unfortunately deadly unintended consequence during the COVID-19 pandemic, and it actually contributed to a spread of the virus. Tell us what occurred and why.
I would say the most robust evidence for what we found is just straight from economic and epidemiological theory. So what happened is economists for a long time have agreed that if you engage in a what's called a binding price ceiling. So what that means, that's kind of some economic jargon, but what we mean by that is that there's some free market price where supply and demand equal each other. Basically, we go into the store, those stores have decided kind of what their price will be based on consumer demand. If we charge too much, people won't buy these goods. If we charge too little, we'll run out of those goods. Well, that's a price that's determined in the market. It's determined by people acting in their own self-interest, kind of going out in the economy, negotiating. Well, a price ceiling is a regulation that says you're not allowed to increase a price above a certain level. If that level is below what the free market would have landed the price on, then that leads to a shortage. And that's well-accepted economic theory that that would lead to a shortage. Price gouging regulations act like price ceilings in public emergencies. And they can be particularly bad because oftentimes they target the goods who are in highest demand during the emergency. So, for example, hand sanitizer was directly targeted by a lot of anti-price gouging regulations. Well, at the same time, everybody was trying to buy more hand sanitizer because of the pandemic. Well, if you don't allow the price to reflect that increase in demand, then you have a shortage. So that's kind of step one. Price gouging regulations lead to a shortage. Step two, toilet paper was a very popular good that we all knew was in shortage during this time. Well, if humans run out of toilet paper and can't find it, step two is I am going to search for toilet paper because most people will not abandon a search for a good like that. Hand sanitizer might be similar. Like, I really want hand sanitizer during a pandemic. So first, we have price gouging. That leads to a shortage. Shortage leads consumers to search around for goods. So those are both the economic theory side of the situation. Well, what happens next is the epidemiology side. Those consumers go to more stores looking for toilet paper, looking for hand sanitizer, and looking for other goods that are subject to price gouging regulation, but are in shortage as a result of price gouging regulation. And now we're working against the social distancing mitigation policy that was at the same time this is all occurring. Stay safe, stay at home. Those were things we were hearing. Well, this policy is pushing directly against that by having people searching for products.
We have been talking with Professor Gavin Roberts. He's an assistant professor of economics at Weber State University. He and his co-author have written a paper on this subject for the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. Tell us a little bit about the Center for Growth and Opportunity. Where can folks go if they'd like to drill down and learn more about this subject and this research?
Well, they can find our research at the Center for Growth and Opportunity's website, which is thecgo.com. And the Center for Growth and Opportunity supports independent research like the paper we wrote, often related to economics and to markets.
Gavin Roberts from the Center for Growth and Opportunity. Professor, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson is at the Club for Growth. There has been a lot of activity on Capitol Hill this past week with passage of the Biden stimulus bill, as we call it. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
This stimulus proposal has been kicking around now for a number of months, Scott, $1.9 trillion. Final passage occurred. Your thoughts on this bill getting through Congress and now apparently lots of money headed out to lots of people?
When the Senate took up the reconciliation package, they changed the bill, and there were a bunch of different provisions that ended up getting tucked in there. And since the bill changed, they had to ping pong it back over to the House. And this week, the House of Representatives ended up passing the bill 220 to 211. And there was actually bipartisan opposition to passage. You had one Democrat stand up and vote no, Jared Golden from the state of Maine. joined with all the Republicans in voting no. And I think that if there was one Republican that voted yes, of course, Joe Biden would be saying that there was bipartisan support for final passage. But there was not bipartisan support. There was bipartisan opposition. So we're going to go with that today. The bottom line, this is an incredibly expensive bill that includes a ton of money that is not related to an emergency in nature or to the pandemic. We've got hundreds of billions of dollars that was built into a formula based on unemployment in states to award states that irresponsibly stayed locked down and shut down and caused higher unemployment levels to receive more money than some of these red states that stayed open or opened up quickly. That's going to ultimately be termed the blue state bailout. And I think that it's a real problem when you're rewarding people that were, in many instances, staying closed to politically harm President Trump and damage his reelection efforts.
How is this going to play out politically now, Scott, as we head into the 2022 midterm elections? Universal Republican opposition, universal Democrat support, sort of like the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare back at the beginning of the Obama administration. Is this something Republicans are going to be able to run on, the fact that over 90% of this bill went for things other than for fighting the pandemic?
Well, there's some voters that certainly care about fiscal sanity and the economic health of the American economy. But I think that that's a small part of the electorate. And the good news for Republicans that want to win back the majority is Democrats are running roughshod over them and trying to pass everything that they can in really a partisan fashion that is in favor of expediency over a thorough debate. They're doing things from background checks on guns. They're doing things to change election laws. The Green New Deal agenda is being reconsidered in an infrastructure package, I think, coming up next. So there's going to be a lot of things for Republicans to sort of say, this is what happens when Democrats get control of government with the House, Senate, and White House. But how many people really pay attention to the ultimate fiscal health of the nation, I think, is a real problem. Right now, interest rates are at really historic lows, and the economy is, in many ways, very fragile. We lost nearly 10 million jobs over the last year, and a lot of those were the jobs for low-income and middle-income Americans that rely on an hourly salary. And so when these wages are being threatened because restaurants and bowling alleys and movie theaters and whatnot, the minimum wage type jobs aren't open, then what are those folks going to do? They're going to obviously turn to government for more support. And then the Democrats love that idea, because when folks are dependent upon the federal government for welfare or other anti-poverty benefits, they feel like they've got a constituency that they can keep going back to, and they can say, oh, we'll give you free education, we'll give you free health care. Well, we know that when the government gives things away for free, it actually increased the cost of everything. So I'm really worried about the economy going forward. I think that $1.9 trillion of spending, that's going to bring our national debt right around the $30 trillion level. This summer, we have a big, big vote on what to do on the debt limit. I would expect that to happen near the end of July. And really, it's bills like the so-called American Rescue Plan, what I would refer to as the Biden stimulus plan. We know that stimulus spending is not good for the economy. It creates stagnation within wages. It creates really, really low gross domestic product growth. And we want to have a recipe to get the economy humming like it was in, you know, January, February of 2020. We need to have a recipe for deregulation, for tax relief, for investment in America, because we need folks to be taking the risks associated with business formation in order to get those 10 million jobs back. I mean, if somebody says, hey, you got to pay everybody 15 bucks at a minimum, I think you're a lot less likely to start that new enterprise.
Scott, you mentioned that there were a number of changes that took place in the Senate from the bill that was sent over to the House on this stimulus package, one of which involved the potential of using some of this money to give taxpayers some relief. What happened there?
Yeah, Chuck Schumer inserted a provision in the 11th hour to prohibit states that were taking money out of the state and local blue state bailout from doing any tax relief. They can't do tax cuts with that money.
and that's all the way through 2024. So can you imagine if no states in America, because all 50 states are getting some federal money, could do tax relief over the next 3 years? I think it's outrageous. I think it's unconstitutional. And I think it's tying the hands of red state governors that really do have a good economy and revenue surpluses. And instead of just putting that into a rainy day fund or giving it to other special interest projects, I think these governors should return the overtaxation to the American people through tax cuts.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Yeah, the Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. If anybody listening is interested in checking us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org. And you can find us on Twitter at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, as always, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
The American Recovery Act was less about fighting the impact of COVID-19 than funding a wish list of left-wing spending priorities. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine takes a deeper dive.
Earlier this week, Congress passed, and on Thursday afternoon, President Joe Biden signed a $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief bill. But, well, actually, hold on. Let's stop right there, because this really isn't a COVID-19 relief bill, and we should probably stop calling it that. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. This week, we're taking a close look at this so-called COVID relief bill, the American Rescue Act that President Joe Biden has signed into law. It is, of course, mostly an expensive bundle of politically motivated giveaways, many of which have very little to do, if anything, to do with the pandemic. Now, of course, it's true that this bill is moving through Congress and moved through Congress at a time when COVID-19 relief is very much sweeping the country. The number of new cases, hospitalizations, and deaths are falling just about everywhere. The number of vaccinations are soaring, and it feels like the end of the pandemic is right around the corner, or at least maybe just a few months away. Biden said just last week that the vaccine supply will be sufficient to cover all Americans who want a shot by the end of May. Some states are lifting economic lockdowns and behavior restrictions. Sweet, sweet pandemic relief is coming. But let's be very clear about this. It is not coming from Congress. No, the bill that Congress passed and Biden signed this week is a larded-up bounty of mostly Democratic policy goals that will ultimately add $1.9 trillion to the national debt. Yes, every last penny of this beast is being put on the national credit card. And only about 5% of that total is actually funding public health efforts related to the pandemic. That's according to the nonpartisan number crunchers at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Beyond that, however, the bill is a steaming pile of government handouts and special interest giveaways. A sizable portion of it, about $500 billion when you add it all up, is a bailout of state and local governments that, for the most part, don't really need them. State tax revenues did take a hit from the pandemic and the economic lockdowns, but the damage is far smaller than was once feared. And of course, states should be able to handle their own finances without bailouts from D.C. But it's not just a bailout. It's a bailout in which the funding is being allocated based on the size of each state's unemployed population. So think about what that means. States that imposed draconian and unnecessary economic lockdowns during the past year obviously have higher unemployment rates right now. They are going to get a larger share of federal cash than states that manage to balance public health needs and the economy more effectively. Another $400 billion of the bill's spending will provide an additional round of stimulus checks to Americans, including people who haven't lost their jobs or income due to the pandemic. Those stimulus payments will be distributed to individuals who earned less than $75,000 last year and couples, married couples, who earned up to $150,000. There's just simply no reason for Congress to be sending money to families that earn six-figure incomes and have experienced minimal financial losses during the pandemic. If putting more money in Americans' pockets is a priority for Congress, it could accomplish that goal by reducing income taxes and, of course, cutting an equal amount of future spending on a permanent basis, not by engaging in these deficit-hiking games merely because free money from from the government is politically popular. The bill also spends $129 billion on K-12 education, money that you might assume is being used to reopen schools quickly and safely, but you would be wrong. The Congressional Budget Office analysis of the bill found that the bulk of that spending won't be allocated to schools until next year at the earliest, and some of it won't be distributed until 2024. Now, that same CBO report also estimates that a total of $480 million in the bill will be spent on miscellaneous educational matters like grants to fund activities related to the arts, humanities, libraries, and museums. Even if those things are important and might be worth spending federal tax dollars on, it's difficult to understand how they are essential to COVID-19 relief by any meaningful definition of the terms. And the same is true for a whole bunch of other stuff in the bill, like funding for a new subway in San Jose, California, or money to build a new bridge connecting New York State to Canada. Those are top priorities for Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat from California, of course, and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat from New York. But those aren't things that belong in a pandemic relief bill, not by any stretch of the imagination. Like the education component, the bill's extension of boosted unemployment benefits through the end of August might seem like something directly related to the pandemic, but those federal payments would increase from $300 per week to $400 per week, and that's on top of what unemployed workers are already getting from state-run programs. And it would increase those payments at a time when the unemployment rate is falling and recovery is underway. That makes little sense, and it also means that two-thirds of America's unemployed workers will now collect more in benefits than they would collect in paychecks if they went back to their old jobs. So that means it's likely to slow the economic recovery as well, according to the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Speaking of being paid not to work, the bill also includes $14 billion to create a new paid family leave program, but it's one that applies only to employees of the federal government. The program will allow federal workers to collect benefits if they have children attending schools that are closed due to COVID-19. In other words, federal employees get paid to stay home with their kids while everyone else has to juggle a full-time job and being a substitute teacher at the same time. I could go on and on, but you probably get the point. Calling this a COVID-19 relief bill is just ridiculous. About the only COVID-19 relief that most Americans need right now comes in a syringe. Once we hit a critical mass of immunity from vaccinations and the state and local government lockdowns are gone, the stimulus is going to happen without any help from Congress or President Biden. In the meantime, lawmakers should work to provide aid to businesses and individuals that face ongoing economic hardship, but that's all. Using the waning pandemic as an excuse for a spending free-for-all when the country is $28 trillion in debt is beyond irresponsible. And trying to pass off this bloated list of politically motivated handouts as essential to America's public health is both dishonest and cowardly. In other words, it's exactly what you would expect from Congress. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of this legislation and everything else that Congress is up to at Reason.com, and catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
As the Biden administration takes shape, conservatives have to find a way forward without Donald Trump in the White House. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College talks about new conservative voices on this American Radio Journal commentary.
A never-Trump colleague of mine, one who reviles Donald Trump, asked me recently why I didn't support a second impeachment of Donald Trump. He asked me that question because I told him that I want to see the conservative movement move beyond Donald Trump. Well, that being the case, why not impeach the sucker, eh? Well, the answer isn't that brutally simple. For starters, the impeachment trial against Donald Trump was from the outset a political spectacle, a rash judgment by Democrats. First, there is the debatable question of whether a non-sitting president could even be impeached. There were also crucial questions not only of whether Donald Trump instigated what happened at the Capitol building on January 6, but how House Democrats could immediately rush to an impeachment vote before an investigation had even been done on whether what happened was pre-planned well in advance. In fact, that's something that everyone from the likes of CNN, MSNBC, NPR, The Washington Post, and, oh, the FBI have reported. Then there was a question of whether those assaulting the building on January 6 started the assault before Donald Trump even finished his rally speech. In fact, the Washington Post and the New York Times printed timelines before the Democrats evidently even thought of one. Moreover, there is also the very significant question of why tens of thousands present at the Trump speech were not instigated to go into the Capitol building versus the couple hundred who allegedly were. In sum, this was a snap House vote without an investigation, without witnesses, in fact, not even in the Senate trial, and without due process against the person charged. It was a political rush job and hack job by Democrats. The country needs to move on. Hey, you want unity? Then pursue unity. Of course, the deeper motivation by Democrats and certain anti-Trump Republicans was to use the second impeachment as a tool to disqualify Donald Trump from running for office again. And that's what perplexed my never-Trump colleague about my position. If I genuinely would like to see the conservative movement move beyond Donald Trump, then why not support a move to disqualify the man from running again? Well, the answer is that the ends don't justify the means. That is a partisan exploitation of the impeachment process. But as to the matter of a conservative movement moving beyond Donald Trump, that's actually something I've longed for since 2015, regardless of whether I can concede that President Trump did things that conservatives should applaud. From being a surprising defender of religious liberty in the pro-life position, from fracking and energy independence and deregulation, from great policies in the Middle East, from making solid court picks and still more. And yet, from the outset, I saw, especially as a college professor, Donald Trump's negative effect on young conservatives in particular. Of course, not all were repelled by him. There were entire conservative youth groups like Turning Point USA that became pro-Trump organizations. Overall, however, many young conservatives found nothing attractive about Trump. Importantly, I'm old enough to tell you and remember that this is completely different from the 1980s, when droves of youth were attracted to conservatism because of the inspiring person and winsome message of President Ronald Reagan. Recall, some of you, the likes of Alex P. Keaton, played by Michael J. Fox on the TV show Family Ties. He reflected a common kind of young conservative. I was one of them. So what I'm urging is to move the conservative movement in 2021 beyond Donald Trump, with new messengers like Rand Paul, Marco Rubio, Nikki Haley, Ted Cruz, Ron DeSantis, Dan Crenshaw, Josh Hawley, Ben Sasse, Kristi Noem, Marsha Blackburn, Jim Jordan. In fact, I polled students in my conservatism course at Grove City College to ask them their favorite conservatives. They listed, perhaps not surprisingly, younger, non-politician voices in the movement, the likes of Ben Shapiro, Candace Owens, Tucker Carlson, Michael Knowles, Amy Coney Barrett, Mark Levin, Glenn Beck, Stephen Crowder. In sum, this is a moment of opportunity for a movement to regain its strength. Conservatism is about an enduring order that, well, endures. It transcends, and it now must endure past Donald Trump. But until then, you don't pursue a political spectacle of an impeachment trial intended to disqualify Donald Trump from running for office again simply for the purpose of getting there. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengore.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KGRG-FM in Auburn, Washington, WGNZ-AM and FM in Daytona, Ohio, along with KZOY-AM in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.